Well, my name's Tony Giddens. I'm going to do the second bit, introducing our visitor this evening. And I'm very pleased to be able to introduce him, since we've been friends and colleagues for a little while. And I have to say, personally, I'm a strong admirer of his writings, and I've learned a great deal from them. So we're very happy that he's here this evening. And I'm going to read you out a bit of bio data about him, in case you don't know. Ben Barber is the Walt Whitman Professor at Rutgers University of Political Science and directs the Center for Culture and Politics of Democracy. He consults regularly with political and civic leaders in the United States and Europe, including President Bill Clinton, Vice President Al Gore, Senator Bill Bradley, well, the list goes on. I'll just add, and other notable figures. His 14 books include the now classic book, I think, Strong Democracy, which I'm sure many people in the audience will know. He wrote a novel in 1981 called Marriage Voices, and his best-known book is the bestseller Jihad vs. McWorld, which is a great book, truly, I think, really one of the best books on the globalization debate. His two most recent books are his collected American essays, The Passion for Democracy, and his study of civil society called A Place for Us. Also a very good book, which I thoroughly recommend, having read it and used it myself along with the others. Here's some of the other things he does. For television, he co-wrote with Patrick Watson the prize-giving CBS PBS 10-part series, The Struggle for Democracy, and a companion book that went along with that. He's also contributed to the Channel 4 series over here called Greek Fire, as well as to the American series, The American Promise, and many other educational documentaries. His work for the theater includes the libretto for George Quincy's opera, Home and the River, and also other interesting activities that I won't list, but well away from the orthodox sphere of political science they seem to be. So you have here a very well-rounded figure. The center which he directs is engaged in a range of different projects, really interesting ones. For example, projects to redevelop commercial space back into civic space, projects to restore civic culture and local democracy, to bring professional artists into public schools and generally connect educational reform with the reform of civic culture. The title of his lecture today is Can Democracy Survive Globalization? He already told me that his answer is no, but I'm not giving too much away by that. So please welcome Ben Barber.
Thank you so much, Tony. In a way, you have given it away. Perhaps I should just take questions now after that answer. It's a great pleasure to be here under the auspices of the Journal of Government and Opposition and the LSE for the Leonard Shapiro lecture. And also, for me, I have special thoughts about Gitza Ionescu, the long-term editor of Government and Opposition and an extraordinary social scientist who represented, I think, the truly international character of the education that goes on and the research that goes on at the London School of Economics. I was a student here in 1958 and had as my tutors that year, some of you will know what this means, nothing good, on the one hand Ralph Miliband for 6 months, and for the second half of the year Michael Oakeshott. And I like to think that accounts for the complexity of my work. My critics say it accounts for the confusion of my work, but you can imagine being exposed at a young and tender age to two such figures in a very short period of time. I've spent a lot of time in the UK. I was back here in the 60s. I was on a senior Fulbright at Essex University in the 70s. But nowadays it's a little hard for a Yank coming back to recognize Britain, because it has indeed been so thoroughly transformed by some of the forces of globalization that I want to talk about today. For example, back in the 70s, when I was last here for an extended period of time, there was a man, probably many of you don't remember him, a man who was involved in what then was called the GLC and local government here. I don't know what's ever happened to him, but I know globalization has changed things, and we're not in a world of Rule Britannia of the kind that Ken Livingstone used to challenge, but instead in a new world of Cool Britannia, in which there's no place, I take it, for men like Ken Livingstone. Well, maybe things change less than we think. But in fact, there have been some fundamental changes here in England and throughout the world that globalization has brought about, and it has created a set of new problems, not just for Tory conservatives who are trying to preserve some piece of this sceptered isle of Albion in a new global world, and by the way, old Tories who have some strange new allies on the streets of London who are equally opposed to the globalization project. It's interesting the kinds of folks who get together around resistances of one kind or another. But I want to talk about those forces of globalization today and their impact on democracy. And in a sense, this comes naturally just a day or two after the demonstrations here. The Daily Telegraph, which I happened to be reading when I first came here, it was the only paper I could find out at Gatwick, called it a highly violent demonstrations. Clearly they're not familiar with violence in the modern world. But nonetheless, there have been demonstrations in Washington, in Seattle, and now here in London, and I'm sure there will be more, suggesting a kind of visceral reaction to the not well understood impact of globalization on democratic society. And I think the instinct a lot of people have, young and old alike, is that whatever else globalization is, it's not much good for democracy. And I want to suggest that to a degree, that is true, and that we need to think about why and see whether there are things that can be done about it. I think I want to start with what is an extraordinary irony in the globalization process, because while we use that term globalization, in fact the encompassing practices of globalization have been radically asymmetrical. That is to say, we've managed to globalize markets in goods, in labor, in currency, and in information, without globalizing the civic and democratic institutions that have historically comprised the free market's indispensable context. Putting it rather simply, we have removed capitalism from the institutional box that has quite literally domesticated it and given it sometimes harsh practices a more human face. From the birth of markets in the 17th century nation-state to the rise of the welfare and regulatory state in the 20th century, the freedom of the market has been secured by the discipline of the law. Ripped from the juridical and legislative box of regulatory institutions and civic infrastructure, markets spin freely into hyperspace, generating a kind of wild capitalism that looks like anarchy, and that is corrosive not only to the national democracies on which it once relied, but on its own operation as a competition-based economic system. Now, I examined the dynamics of globalization in some detail in Jihad versus McWorld, and I won't rehearse those arguments here, but in the 5 or 6 years since that work appeared, McWorld has proceeded apace, and globalization has, I think, a new, not a necessarily human, but a new face as we cross the millennial threshold. It is ever more efficient in its domination of other sectors because it acts today in concert with a series of other forces, which I want to comment on briefly this afternoon. Privatization, commercialization, and a consumer culture that is both infantilizing consumers and having a totalizing effect on society at large. This concert of forces, more than globalization alone, has been damaging to the pluralism of our society and the democracy of our political and civic life. To survive the slow passing of the nation state, democracy will itself have to find a road to globalization. Now, to understand why taking capitalism out of the box has been so calamitous for democracy, we have to recall in the history of capitalism and free markets that there's been a kind of synergy between democratic institutions inside the nation state and the growth of efficient and productive, but also domesticated capitalist institutions. Democracy has been a precondition for free markets, not, as economists try to argue so often today, the other way around. As representation and suffrage were extended, entrepreneurial capitalism grew alongside them. As England's monarchy first moved away from monarchical rule to constitutional rule and gradually gave way to more democratic elements, its economy moved from mercantilism to industrial capitalism and free trade, the latter taking full root only in the 19th century after the Reform Acts. The freedom of the market that has helped sustain freedom in politics and a spirit of competition in the political domain has been nurtured in turn by democratic institutions. Contract law and regulation, as well as cooperative civic relations and syndicalism, have attenuated capitalism's Darwinism and contained its irregularities, its contradictions, its tendencies toward self-destruction around monopoly and the eradication of competition. Now, on the global plane today, this historical symmetry that paired democracy and capitalism has gone missing. We've globalized the marketplace willy-nilly because markets can bleed through porous national boundaries and are not constrained by the logic of sovereignty. But we have not even begun to globalize democracy, which, precisely because it is political, because it is defined by sovereignty, is trapped inside the nation-state box. There are, of course, a legion of transnational civic and governmental organizations in the global arena, perhaps as many as 60,000 NGOs in addition to traditional United Nations-style political and cultural associations. Many of these, however, are plagued by national conflicts or paralyzed by the non-participation by principles. The United States is not a signatory to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, or the Landmine Treaty, for example, and hasn't paid its United Nations dues nor renewed its lapsed membership in UNESCO. In any case, by almost any measure of real power, there is not a single NGO that can hold a candle to powerful communications multinational corporations. Is Civicus, that wonderful little organization of about 400 NGOs that meets every year in a capital around the world, is Civicus a match for Murdoch's News Corporation? Can the ILO give Viacom, CBS, or Disney ABC a run for their money? And these firms, by the way, can't even tolerate one another, as one saw from last week's sparring match between ABC, Viacom, and the cable company, which refused to run it. Can, in fact, transnational associations that promote pluralism in communications confront an AOL, Time Warner, at all when the U.S. government, in the 1996 telecommunications bill, passed up the chance for the most modest forms of regulation, and that under a Democratic president? Who will actually put the human face on the WTO that President Clinton has suggested it so desperately needs? Where nation states do try to act collectively and in effect pool their political sovereignties in order to constrain and regulate multinational corporations and the social and the cultural impact of markets, it turns out that their governments often seem more interested in protecting the autonomy and sovereignty of markets than insisting on their own citizens' public interests. Here, privatization ideology has made sovereign governments into better stewards of global economic interests than of national or international civic interests. Hence, the WTO, nominally the resistors in the streets sometimes seem to forget, a creature of its member states, is in truth more representative of the corporate and financial interests that dominate those states' internal politics. In this, the kids on the street, for all their simplifications and naivetes, are probably right. They miss the fact that the international financial institutions are constitutive by member states, but they are right in thinking that those member states, in fact, often deploy the interests of international banks and corporations rather than the civic interests of their own citizens. Recently, there was a piece that you might think was written by one of the demonstrators in Washington or Seattle or London. It said this: they'll say the IMF is secretive and insulated from democratic accountability. They'll say the IMF's economic remedies often make things worse, turning slowdowns into recessions and recessions into depressions. And they'll have a point. That's Joseph Stiglitz, who is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors to Clinton and then the deputy director and chief economist of the World Bank. So that's from the inside, that's not from the street. In fact, the power of finance on the inside of nation-state politics reinforces the outlaw market libertarianism that typifies so much of globalism today. In the United States, which could be a leader in imposing democratic order on the global economy, something hinted at in President Clinton's maverick speech on behalf of health, safety, and environmental standards in Seattle, and then again repeated at the 2000 meeting of the Davos World Economic Forum, the interests of global markets are in fact secured by the private funding of elections, which actually legitimates a shift of sovereignty from politics to the economy. Now, back in the 19th century, when trade and durable goods and natural resources were the primary features of trade, in fact, the percentage of GNP of nation states devoted to international trade was as great as today. And some critics have used that to suggest that the whole globalization preoccupation is an obsession of journalists and not real. And it is true that if you look merely at those statistics, that is the case. But in fact, in that period, hard trade actually reinforced nationalism, undergirding national economies and helping to create a world of powerful nation states, a world of nationalisms and nationalist ideologies of a kind that made both autonomy and democracy possible, and of course also led to the clash of nations that gave rise to two world wars. Where trade then reinforced nationalism, however, today it undermines it, eroding parochial borders of every kind and turning the global economy as an information economy into an engine of transformation and interdependence. It's not just percentages that tell the story, since as much of 80% of today's trade remains trade in manufactured and durable goods as in the late 19th and early 20th century. But the remaining 20% representing the service and information economy dominates the character and impact of trade as a whole and gives to globalization its genuinely transnational, transformative character. With the spread of the new globalization, the asymmetry between private vices and public goods has deepened. In globalizing private rather than public goods, we've managed, perhaps inadvertently, to globalize many of our vices and almost none of our virtues. We've globalized crime, the rogue weapons trade, terror. We've globalized hate propaganda, sometimes ironically using the modern technologies of the World Wide Web itself to promote ideologies hostile to technology and to anything smacking of the world wide or the modern. We've globalized drugs. We've globalized pornography, the trade in women and children made possible by porn tourism. Indeed, I think one can say the most egregious globalization has been the globalization of the exploitation and abuse of children in war, pornography, poverty, and sex tourism. Nowhere are children more abused now than in this international arena, where their interests cannot possibly be represented other than by the price their services bring as prostitutes, slave laborers, involuntary organ donors, or soldiers. Tribal wars can now be primarily conducted through and against children, our proxy warriors in the new century. It's a toss-up whether a 9-year-old girl born into poverty in Brazil or Thailand can be more profitably exploited by selling her virginity or her kidneys in the international marketplace. By the way, in Manuel Castells' remarkable 3-volume study of the network society, there is an excellent section which spells out the specific economic connections. I know what I just said is somewhat rhetorical, but the rhetoric is backed by specific economic connections between the kinds of abuses I talked about and the character of the global market. And in fact, the global economy's impact on children is but one example of its civic sterility. Lacking a civic envelope, it cannot support the values and institutions associated with civic culture, religion, and the family. Nor can it enjoy their potential softening, domesticating, and civilizing impact on raw market transactions. No wonder Pope John Paul said in his apostolic exhortation on the mission of the Roman Catholic Church in the Americas last year when he visited Latin America, and I quote Pope John, "If globalization is ruled merely by the laws of the market applied to suit the powerful, the consequences cannot be but negative." Now, of course, one expects the Pope to moralize in this fashion. He is, after all, a professional moralizer. More startling is a similar message from another more powerful Pope of the secular world, who wrote recently, and I quote, "You hear talk about a new financial order, about an international bankruptcy law, about transparency, and more. But you don't hear a word about people. 2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. We live in a world that's gradually getting worse and worse and worse. It's not hopeless, but we have to do something about it now." Close quote. The moralist here is the hard-headed James Wolfensohn, president of the World Bank, who in fact has begun to replace the bank's traditional energy and industrialization projects thought to favor the interests of foreign investors with environmental and health projects aimed at the interests of the populations being directly served. And we need, in fact, to distinguish between, we can't keep saying WTO, IMF, World Bank in a single breath, because there are significant distinctions in the policies between them. Joseph Stiglitz, who I cited earlier, has complained that the IMF won't even listen to the World Bank, let alone anybody else. So one wants to make those distinctions. Now, there are, of course, extant international institutions that might serve as building blocks for a global democratic box into which the economy might be safely put. The international financial institutions conceived at Bretton Woods after World War II to oversee the reconstruction of a shattered Europe and the Asian economies as well were originally intended to function as regulatory agencies to assure peaceful, stable, and democratic redevelopment under the watchful eye of the victorious Allied powers. Though the World Bank and the IMF and later the GATT and the WTO that grew out of it in 1995 were ostensibly forged as instruments of democratic nation states designed to guide and regulate private sector interests in the name of public sector reconstruction, over a period of time they became instruments of the very private sector interests they were meant to channel and keep in check. That happened as early as the late 40s. When the World Bank insisted that the French government get rid of every communist in the cabinet before a $250 million reconstruction loan could be made. And that was the beginning of a long series of interventions about which we might have our own political opinions, but which turned what was to have been a economic regulatory agency into a political regulatory agency, more interested in intervening in the politics than the economies of the nations it claimed to be serving. Those who today call for the elimination of these institutions in the name of transparency, accountability, and democracy might in fact be surprised to learn that these norms, or their earlier equivalents, were once regarded as among the post-war financial order's primary objectives. Given the role the modern institutions representing this order play as potential pieces in a global regulatory infrastructure, one way to begin the process of global democratization would be to re-democratize them and subordinate them to the will of democratic peoples, something that President Clinton hinted at in his Seattle and Davos speeches. But there's a problem here. Globalization does not occur in a vacuum. Its corrosive impact on democratic governance and our inability to put international financial institutions that are nominally already at the service of democracy to real democratic use is augmented by the cognate ideology of privatization that is prevalent both in the international scene and within the countries whose economies are being globalized. Privatization, what Europeans often call neoliberalism and what George Soros has rather nicely called market fundamentalism, is an ideology that saps democracy by attacking public power. By arguing that markets can do everything government once did better than government, and with more freedom for citizens, privatization within nation states opens the way for a deregulation of markets that in turn facilitates the globalization of the economy. It softens up citizens to accept the decline of political institutions and tries to persuade them they'll be better off, more free, when their collective democratic voice is stilled. Ultimately, it permits national governments to acquiesce in the use of the IMF and the WTO as servants of private interests, since private interests within and among nations become the overriding sovereign. As an ideology, privatization reverses the old and successful tradition of social contract theory on which America and other Western democracies were founded. Social contract reasoning postulates that only those forms of public power resting on popular sovereignty can be legitimate, because only such forms can be transparent, accountable, and rooted in consent, that is, in the free will, and hence the liberty of individuals. The ideology of privatization insists, to the contrary, that private power, unencumbered by law, regulation, or government, is the essence of freedom, and hence is a more legitimate species of power than that sustained by the old social contract. This argument is not only neoliberal, but libertarian, arguing that freedom can exist only in the absence of government. Not only libertarian, but nearly anarchist, arguing that every form of public rule smacks of illegitimacy. This internal critique of democratic legitimacy within nations rationalizes the anarchy of the international market sector, making its escape out of the democratic box seem like a virtue rather than a problem. Privatization puts the public sector on the defensive. By modeling a national society where liberty is defined by free markets and government has been cast as a villain whose power must be minimized, it lends credibility to a global market where there's no government at all. For national government now becomes an instructed instrument of private economic interests rather than of public and civic goods. In this guise, it's made over into a useful tool of global corporations, banks, and markets in international organizations like the WTO and the IMF, nominally political organizations constituted by sovereign states, but in fact servants of global economic interests that undermine national sovereignty. Now, some Democrats will hesitate here, wondering whether the assault on national government by privatizing ideology is not in fact a good thing for civil society and for neighborhood governance. This, however, is to confound privatization and decentralization. The latter, decentralization, strengthens democracy. The former only corrupts and undermines it. With decentralization, the public sector and its governing institutions transfer power down the governing hierarchy to provinces, to states, to municipalities and neighborhoods, thereby empowering citizens to take greater public responsibility and become engaged in government on the local level. This is an instance of what is sometimes called subsidiarity, a devolution of public accountability that takes top-down political power that is transparent and public and turns it into bottom-up political power that becomes even more transparent and even more public by virtue of its being local. Privatization is an entirely different animal. It does not decentralize. It shifts top-down power that is public, accountable, and transparent, if also sometimes inefficient and bureaucratic, to the private sector, where it remains top-down but is now private, unaccountable, and opaque. Privatization gives public power away. It annihilates its public character, often leaving it at the top of some hegemonic or elite ladder, but now in powerful private hands beyond scrutiny. In the name of liberty, privatization destroys democracy. Privatization's sometimes greater efficiency is then used to rationalize the destruction of res publica, the goods of the public in whose name republics are constituted in the first place. In the process, citizens do not approach closer to power, but are further distanced from it. Something like this happened in Russia, where power was wrested from the hands of public authorities who were, however, only quasi-legitimate, and embraced by private authorities who were altogether illegitimate. To empower new private hierarchical bureaucracies in place of inefficient or bungling public bureaucracies may be a victory for instrumental efficiency, but it is certainly not a victory for democracy. President Clinton's proclamation of the end of the era of big government in 1996 unfortunately did not do so much to free us from public democracy, public bureaucracy, as it did to introduce us to a new era of big business and to legitimate private bureaucracy. We may welcome New Democrat skepticism about traditional welfare state strategies, but we cannot allow the end of the welfare state to spell the end of welfare, of the common wealth. Regimes of profit simply cannot and will not take responsibility for the welfare of children, artists, teachers, soldiers, let alone education, culture, or the common defense. An ideology that tries to convince people to connive in their own disempowerment is surely a swindle. In the end, though this was certainly not President Clinton's intention, the end of big government may turn out to have been just such a con game, whose real consequences was not to make overt war on bureaucracy, but to make covert war on democracy. To be sure, the big bureaucracies engendered by well-meaning big governments in the era of the Great Society and the New Deal did contribute to the creation of an unbounded welfare state that became bloated, bureaucratic, inefficient, and dependency breeding. I agree with those criticisms. But to redress these defects requires the reform of democracy, not its elimination. Jefferson insisted the only effective remedy for the defects of democracy is more democracy. Neoliberals prefer to think the remedy for the defects of democracy is no democracy at all. After all, they say, and here's the second line of argument, aren't markets themselves essentially democratic? This is, in fact, neoliberalism's other line of argument, one that affirms privatization as a reasonable strategy for Democrats. It averts the swindle portrayed above by redefining democracy down, by in effect privatizing the idea of government. And so, without acknowledging or perhaps even understanding what it's doing, eviscerating democracy by depublicizing it. Let's take the common out of commonwealth, is its slogan. This second strategy argues that privatization actually enhances democracy by giving citizens the only vote that really counts, the vote cast by their consumer dollars. After all, through the purchasing power of the dollar, the pound, the D-mark, or the euro, citizens are able to, quote, vote as private persons and have a powerful effect on national outcomes. Skeptics like me who doubt the virtues of the consumer economy, in fact, are elitists and not democracy, because we don't trust the people to make the decisions. We're trying to tell people how to make their own decisions. Privatization, the consumerist argument continues, does not eliminate politics. It only privatizes it and permits us to vote powerful dollars or pounds, a little less powerful pounds, in the consumer marketplace rather than meaningless preferences in the political voting booth. If choice is the essence of democracy, consumers busy shopping are surely model citizens. This argument for privatization, however well meant, suffers from fatal misunderstandings. It contains two particularly egregious errors. The first in its conception of what a voluntary choice really is. The second, and more important, in its failure to comprehend the crucial distinction between public and private choices as they affect our common lives. Now, I don't want to succumb here to the false claims of false consciousness, to which one denies that ordinary people know what they're doing when they make consumer choices. Although we still have to recognize that how we spend our dollars and pounds and euros is not always quite as free as it feels. Save us from what we want, reads a postmodern prayer in this advertising and merchandising age. The psychology of wants and needs in an era of pervasive consumption surely calls for some problematizing of the term voluntary. Our freely made choices are, after all, subject to marketing, merchandising, advertising, and packaging, all of which, as the billions spent in this sector suggests, are intended, if not to compel, at least to divert choice to what producers want and need to sell in a productivist economy. The merchandising of novel products for which there's no evident initial need and the marketing of brands rather than goods have made markets something less than mechanisms for the satisfaction of natural demands without making them actually coercive. If traditional capitalism once manufactured goods to meet the felt needs of ordinary men and women, postmodern capitalism appears to manufacture needs to assure the sale of a surfeit of goods which people may or may not actually want. Recent efforts at the wholesale commercialization of education are obvious attempts in the United States, and now I think increasingly in Britain as well, at manipulating preferences and conditioning choice. Student unions in the United States have become malls devoted to the pedagogy of brand loyalty. Four-year-olds are now targets for the selling of brand identities on the internet. School buses in cities like Colorado Springs, public school buses, have become acceptable advertising venues, and six-year-olds now ride to school surrounded by advertising. The television network called Channel One offers 9 minutes of soft news and 3 minutes of hard advertising to high school students in 12,000 American schools across America. In return for cheap hardware leased to needy, mostly inner-city schools, desperate administrators offer access to their students' minds during history and social studies classes. Radio stations are now regularly using digital programs to compress human speech, eliminating the ums and ahs and the dead spaces between words in order to increase the time available for advertising. And to my astonishment, I learned that that time may allow as many as six more 30-second ads, or 3 full minutes per hour of advertising, once you compress speech digitally in that fashion. These strategies of persuasion and manipulation are not necessarily fatal. Human autonomy has survived far more grievous assaults, and I've already made clear I'm not a fan of false consciousness arguments that deny ordinary people an intrinsic capacity to judge and an ability to resist those who would condition them. Yet consumer choice in this era of unbounded advertising and merchandising occurs in a setting where almost every domain, educational, cultural, civic, and artistic, has been privatized and commercialized, and where the selling of brands has become the prelude to the selling of goods. And surely we'd have to think that such choice is something less than perfectly autonomous. But the case against private liberty as a surrogate for public choice does not depend on the tainting of the idea of consumer autonomy. The second and more important conceptual defect of the privatization argument is that it confounds public and private modes of choosing. Consumer choice, even if genuinely free, and if we can really be said to need all the things we want, is always, nevertheless, private and personal choice. Private choices, autonomous or not, cannot affect rationally public outcomes. Democratic governance is not just about choosing, it is about public choosing, about dealing with the social consequences of our private choice and behavior. What we do as citizens is precisely to deal with the public consequences of the private choices we make as consumers and private individuals, to treat together with the social entailments of what we do alone. One may enjoy large, fast cars, and other things being equal, choose as a consumer to fuel up with high-powered but environmentally unsafe leaded petrol and drive the biggest possible sports utility vehicle one can find to protect the family against other vehicles. But of course, other things aren't equal. In buying a sports utility vehicle and filling it up on leaded fuel as a private consumer, one does not, in fact, wish for more highway casualties or ubiquitous dead forests. In fact, one does not even think about them when one makes one consumption choices, not as a private consumer. It's only as a public citizen that one reckons the public costs of private decisions taken without forethought of social consequence. Hence, as a citizen, one may gladly veto one's own private consumer preferences and vote for reasonable controls on fuels, on engine emissions, on bumper heights, and on car weights. In other words, as a citizen, one can trump the decisions one makes as a consumer and thereby offset the deleterious impact of private consumer choices on public outcomes. When the citizen in me trumps the consumer in me, it's not a matter of altruism or patriotism, but simply a matter of enlightened self-interest, the personal interest I have in securing public goods in which I share. In Rousseau's language, through participation in the general will, we can regulate our private wills to our own public and community interests. Now, the marketplace offers us the opportunity to express our economic preferences, but we cannot make political or social decisions in that way. We need public institutions to react to the social and public consequences of a marketplace that is more expansive than ever before. And of course, environmentalism affords the most obvious example here. This is to apply to economic behavior the distinction that John Stuart Mill made, calling self-regarding behavior, where we have a right to personal autonomy and privacy, and distinguishing it from other regarding behavior, which is subject to public legislation and control. Citizens are public choosers, and democracy is how we assure that public choosing is legitimate and judicious. That's why it's both a noxious tribute to the power of privatization and a marker of our deep confusion about the difference between public and private goods in the new century that there's a question, as in the headline of a recent Newsweek article on the Human Genome Project, a question about, quote, this was the cover of Newsweek magazine 2 weeks ago, who should own the code of life? If God strikes you as an insufficiently secular and insufficiently modern example, surely private for-profit biotech corporations that have taken out patents on individual human genes they've discovered may strike you as an insufficiently humane and public answer to the same question. Under the rules of both democracy and morality, the code of life presumably must belong to some version of us rather than to a series of corporate me's. To think that the human genome can be privatized and reproduced as a series of biotech consumer products that are parceled out for a price, like so many Pokemon cards, is precisely to imagine one can replace citizens with consumers and call the results democracy. This second confusion becomes the occasion for the first, and the first seems to rationalize the second. There are many things, it's true, that government cannot do very well, but there are many others that only government can do, even when it does them badly, or at least ought to feel obligated to do, such as the need to regulate, to protect, and sometimes subsidize the public things, the res publica, for which we as a public are accountable. These res publica include education, culture, incarceration, transportation, defense, healthcare, and yes, I think the human genome. We can debate them one by one, but that there is a sector of such res publica seems to me to be beyond debate. They represent the public goods that are necessarily under the accountable surveillance of public institutions. Now, 30 years ago, many liberals, and I include myself here, subscribed to the Great Society myth that government could do just about everything. And we were wrong. And today, that myth has been banished. And many of the abuses of an encroaching welfare state bureaucracy have been moderated. But the old myth has been replaced with an equally dangerous new myth, or rather, I should say, the revival of a still more ancient myth, the myth that government can do nothing and markets can do everything. To fall prey to this myth is to forget what James Madison, hardly a fan of unbounded government, wrote in Federalist No. 63. And I quote Madison, "Liberty may be endangered by the abuses of liberty, as well as the abuses of power. And the former, the abuses of liberty, rather than the latter, are apparently most to be apprehended in these United States." A prescient formulation in the 18th century of a 21st century problem. Privatization may seem to be in the interest then of an empowered civil society, but in practice it has meant the commercialization of much of what has been privatized, and hence a further disempowerment of civic associations such as the neighborhood, the church, the foundation, and the family. These domains remain public, though they are non-governmental, and though they are defined by liberty, they are not private. The confounding of public and private has subjected them to a privatization and commercialization by a runaway economic sector that dominates every other demand of what is supposed to be a pluralistic life world. Privatization has led to the commercialization of what was once a pluralistic zone of many identities, encroaching on the essential pluralism of the civic sphere itself. That's the great strength of the civic sphere, it's pluralism. Where a pluralistic civil society nurtures students, friends, colleagues, neighbors, creators, associates of every color and kind who engage in non-governmental but social activities like education, art, philanthropy, recreation, prayer, research, play, moral and social development, and myriad forms of civic and social association, the market sector can afford to nurture only producers and consumers organized around the single-minded pursuit of working and shopping. The free spaces in civil society, such as churches and union halls and neighborhoods in which citizens have traditionally learned the arts of liberty, are now much diminished. And with them, as Robert Putnam has shown, and now the published version, the book version of his article, Bowling Alone, there has been an alarming decline in every conceivable index of social membership in civil society, in social trust, in social capital over the last 30 years in the United States. And similar studies started up elsewhere show a parallel decline. This decline defines the contraction of civic space and the expansion of commercial space, for Putnam most notably in the form of television and the internet. In place of grown-up citizens, we seem intent on developing a nation of childish private consumers, in part by constructing venues for living that are strictly commercial. Malls, theme parks, multiplexes, and their virtual counterpart on the internet, which despite its promise as a civic and educational medium, has become little more than a cyber mall. This emphasis on children goes to the heart of, in fact, a project I'm working on now, which I want to say a word about in connection with this, because if globalization has meant privatization, and privatization has been accompanied by radical commercialization, colonizing commercialism has increasingly demanded a quite astonishing and perfectly overt and explicit infantilizing of consumers. Aggressive marketing is gradually turning public citizens into self-interested individuals, individuals into consumers, and then both turning consumers into children and turning children into consumers. And I don't mean this as mere rhetoric. I mean this is an application of infantilization theory to what merchandisers and marketers are actually doing in the real world of sales. Now, this is in part a response to the imperatives of globalization. In order to sell goods across borders to a global audience traditionally segmented into mature societies with significant civilizational differences, sellers must target relatively ubiquitous needs and relatively universal wants. They must speak a global consumerist language. Since needs and wants vary as societies become more complex and differentiated, this logic has pointed to children as ideal consumers and has used profiles of children's tastes and habits as models even for adult global marketing. This does not necessarily mean selling exclusively to children, but it does mean selling to the child in every man and woman. Merchandising has reached down into the ranks of teens, preteens, and primary schoolers. Today, it does not shrink from directing its salesmanship at preschoolers and toddlers. The teen market is particularly appetizing because teens combine adult spending power and impetuous childish desire unconstrained by adult responsibilities. Peter Zolo, a key writer in this area of children's and teen marketing, writes with mock surprise, I quote, "The stereotype of today's teen is that of a brand-obsessed, label-driven, mall-congregated, free-spending, compulsive shopper." And then he adds with a wink, "And there's often some truth to stereotypes." He continues, his instinct for the kill carrying him to the end, "Teen spending is on the rise, and few teens are saddled with payments that inhibit adult spending, like rent, utilities, and groceries. Teens' considerable income is almost exclusively discretionary. They are consumers with a mission. They want to spend on whatever happens to please them." What a compelling target, he concludes. Now, teens are the most obvious target. Those who will become teens are also enticing, especially if they can be uprooted from the protective home turf of the family and approached as autonomous consumers. The internet offers four-year-olds access, and until the federal government in the United States finally drew a line in the sandbox in the spring of 2000, the internet regularly queried four-year-olds about their family's spending habits and their own buying habits as a condition of their logging on to play sites. Books offering tips on marketing to children multiply under titles like A Marketer's Guide to a Kid's Heart, or What Kids Buy and Why, or Kids as Customers. He spells it with a C, not a K, thank God. In his final chapter on kids as global consumers, McNeil gets to the heart of the new interest in children in a global market by focusing on the common tastes and underdeveloped desires of children as a way around the otherwise obstructive diversity of mature cultures without sufficiently common tastes or wants. And I quote now James McNeil, a marketing professor. Quote, in general, it appears that before there is a geographic culture, there is a children's culture. That children are very much alike around the world. They love to play, they love to snack, and they love being children with other children. The result is they very much want the same things, that they generally translate their needs into similar wants that tend to transcend culture. Therefore, it appears that fairly standardized multinational marketing strategies to children around the globe are viable. That's his understated conclusion, and a conclusion that in effect says if you want to target goods across cultures, then design them for and sell them to children. We, of course, have to ask children to grow up fast in order to become consumers, so that they have a discretionary income, even as we dumb down consumers by plying them with the wares of children, playing to adult-like consumers in every child and the childish, impulsive infant in every adult. The result is a new consumer who is neither a kid nor an adult, but what I like to call the kidults, with grown-up buying power and childish uniform taste that can be catered to by fast food, athletic shoes, T-shirts, cola drinks, Gap-style co-ed clothes based loosely on sports apparel, and the merchandising and branding engine behind all of this, the global pop culture of homogenized MTV music and Hollywood's cartoonish, if not actually cartoon, blockbuster films and videos. The world has marveled at the talent Hollywood film and video makers have brought to the global table in appealing to a worldwide transcultural audience. National film industries in traditionally influential countries like France, Italy, India, and Mexico, and of course the UK as well, have watched their audiences transfer their loyalty to American films, often despite government-imposed quotas and film industry subsidies. This is not a case of American culture trumping French or Indian or British culture. It's a question of kids' fare trumping adult fare in America and around the world. Hollywood has mastered the art of kids' entertainment for the kid and every grown-up, and so has accomplished a commercial end run around sophisticated and adult cultural competitors in every country where it competes, including the United States, where films for grown-ups remain a specialty of small independent film companies that win a greater share of awards than of the mass audience. Fast food succeeds by playing the same game, catering to the unformed sugar and fat tastes and the quick snack-style eating favored by children everywhere, at the expense of slowly developed, culturally differentiated palates and slow-moving ritual eating ceremonies in which adults celebrate family and community ties and manifest their cultural and religious traditions. Malls offer not restaurants, but fuel-up pit stops for busy shoppers, with diverse ethnic fare watered down to appeal to the underdeveloped kid's palate, but which can claim nonetheless to be multicultural, as in fast tandoori or fast kebab. McDonald's cannot, of course, offer a fast food Thanksgiving dinner, because Thanksgiving is about ceremony and community ritual, not about fueling up on sugar and starch. While kids are notoriously intolerant of long-winded ritual meals that are essential not just to a mature civilization, but to turning them in time into mature adults. I think we can expect neither Taco Bell nor Burger King, should the occasion arise, to serve up a new Last Supper. Sports apparel is another example of simplified branded clothes that erase traditional cultural distinctions and replace them with universal brand associations that are themselves placeholders for commodities and consumer goods that make cultural or ethnic markers secondary. Compare the baseball cap to the Sikh turban or the yarmulke. Compare the Nike swoosh embroidered t-shirt to the chador or the sari. Compare the Air Jordan sneaker to the Dutch sabot. The things we wear increasingly disclose not who we are, but where we shop, which of course becomes the new definition of who we are. In the new identity politics, we are what we wear, and what we wear depends on what we watch on the mass media, on the brands we choose, rather than identities that in part at least choose us, such as religion and ethnicity. Now, this might make identity more voluntary, but it also makes freedom lighter than air and choice a matter of a child's whim, as shaped by the commercializing whimsy of those who play tutor to kiddie markets everywhere. Progressive Jewish schools in New York have now surrendered to the merchandisers and are permitting kids to wear yarmulkes to shula that are stitched with professional sports team logos or a Nike swish. The infantilization of consumers brings with it a new ethos that can be compared in its efficacy to the ethos that Protestantism brought to early capitalism. Max Weber charted the complex relationship between the rise of capitalism and the Protestant ethos by showing how Protestant ethics gave to entrepreneurial activity in capitalism's early productivist phase the imprimatur of such norms as the idea of work as a calling, the idea of saving and hence investment as a virtue, and the idea of capitalism itself as a blessing of the Christian imagination. The Protestant ethos certainly celebrated the virtues associated with maturity, and to be sure, with repression, prudence, discipline, productivity, and hard work. And eventually, it helped channel the energies of the new American Republic into the world's most successful economy through American Calvinism in its Puritan form. This is an old story, often retold. The ethos demanded by consumerist capitalism in its late postmodernist phase, however, must reinforce a culture of consumption and leisure time that is geared not to maturation, but to the preservation of childhood. For the first time in history, perhaps, the discipline and rational prudence and even the repression of a society's informal pedagogy and cultural ethos are arrayed against moral, spiritual, and civic growth and complexity, and the diversity they entail. Instead, their aim, their explicit aim, is retardation, keeping kids kids as long as possible and turning adults back into kids as soon as possible. They are squarely on the side of children and the impulsive, playful, leisure time behavior typical of children. Historically, democracy's educational, cultural, and civic institutions have made league with the grown-up in every child, countering the naturally impulsive, playful, leisure time inclinations that are typical of children. While recognizing the need for a space in which children can be children, they have represented Aristotelian forces of development and maturation aimed ultimately at civilizing the child's simple instincts and domesticating her impetuous energies. The infant cannot distinguish self and world and is drawn to the twin illusions. This is the psychology of infantilization, is drawn to the twin illusions of totally mastering the world by supplanting it with the self, and totally merging the self into the world by yielding up the self completely. Dominion or surrender, those are the illusions of the only adults fully comprehend the need for the mediation of a fully formed self and the external world through healthy relationships of interdependency that assume neither mastery nor acquiescence. This is Freud's narrative, no less than Weber's, Aristotle's, no less than Kant's. There have, of course, been rebels like Nietzsche and Foucault who have associated this civilizing process entirely with repression. And Freud himself acknowledged the repressive element, but understood repression as a useful tool of the maturation of the ego. Ironically, today's consumerist ideologists and merchandisers like to mimic the liberationist language of Foucault and Nietzsche when rationalizing the liberation of consumerist passions. However, it's rationalized in our privatized consumerist society, the forces occupying the place of traditional pedagogy and culture are effectively committed to impeding development and de-civilizing the society. The twin illusions of mastery over the material world through the power of consumer purchases and surrender to the material world through a yielding to brand identity mimic the infantile illusions maturation is supposed to overcome. The struggle is not between children and adults, but between the model child and the model adult that wrestles in each individual's soul for ultimate control. Resistance is hard. This is the poisonous gift of infantilization, because we do not really feel unfree. On the contrary, we not only relish our servitude to markets and malls, like kids, we identify it with freedom. Privatized, commercialized, and infantilized, we feel powerful the way infants feel powerful when they stare at their moving hands and think they are commanding the known universe. Our lives and habits seem as if they have been liberated from tradition, discipline, constraint, and history. And so they are. We do become new men, new women. But we've seen such promises of a new identity for the human race in the century just concluded, most often from new forms of politics, a new American man, a new Soviet man, a new Aryan man, more recently the hombre nuevo of Castro's Cuban Revolution. Shifting his gaze from politics to socioeconomic culture, Herbert Marcuse worried 35 years ago about the reductive capacity of the capitalism of his time. It too threatened a new man with what he called once one-dimensional man. He was an optimist. The danger today is no-dimensional man, the coming of the man without qualities, in that wonderful title of the Austrian novel of the 30s, Der Mann ohne Tugendschaften, a personality in which brand names and the collections of consumer attributes on which brand names are parasitic become markers of identity and organizers of meaning. Tom Peters, a horribly successful American management consultant who sells a couple million of each of his books, opened his most recent book on management style with the imperative, and I quote, "Consider yourself a brand. Act like one. Think like one." While the consultant, Laurel Cutler, disagreeing mildly with him, insisted that the quest for identity is best understood not as embracing a brand, but as a shopping expedition among several brands. Identity itself to be constituted by no single brand name, but by a quote, blending of preferred brands. True to the pathological side of infantilism, this is identity from the outside in, masquerading as identity from the inside out. Unrecognized coercion parading as freedom. The outer-directed man has been around for a half century, ever since William White distinguished it from inner-directed man in his morose ode to the gray flannel suit called The Organization Man. Today, the outer-directed man dwells in a world where outer has been reduced to a commercial essence that seems to have colonized the psyche and captured the terrain of the inner. I'm loath to use the term totalitarian here, for the notion is mired in Cold War ideology and, where used by those it's injured, embodies a history of spiritual captivity, terror, imprisonment, and death which ought not to be analogized for rhetorical purposes. Yet George Soros, no stranger to totalitarianism in its earlier incarnation, declares bluntly that, quote, "the central contention of my new book on globalization is that market fundamentalism is today a greater threat to the open society than any totalitarian ideology." Moreover, the fecklessness which those who have eluded totalitarianism's terrors ignore the dangers of the neoliberal system they credit with its defeat does rather invite the comparison.
Salman Rushdie is typical of critics of the idea that there can be anything wrong with capitalism triumphant. To him, to argue that the market unencumbered may conceal a new soft totalism of its own is, he thinks, to misread the threat to liberty, which, to him and to market neoliberals, continues to emanate from states. Hence, Rushdie argues that since the United States is, quote, the best current guarantor of freedom against freedom's enemies, tyranny, bigotry, intolerance, and fanaticism, and now I quote Rushdie, those who oppose the spread of American culture take up arms against the wrong foe. And lest his target be misapprehended, he adds, quote, perhaps we too need to rethink our easy condemnations of American culture. Sneakers, burgers, blue jeans, and music videos aren't the enemy. If the young people of Iran now insist on rock concerts, who are we to criticize their cultural contamination? Out there are real tyrants to defeat. Let's keep our eyes on the prize. Well, Rushdie's certainly right to remind us that the mall is not a gulag. But with his eyes focused skyward in the familiar threat, in the matter familiar to those who feel threatened from totalizing states that imperil liberty from above, he seems to be unable to notice the far less familiar threat from totalizing markets that imperil liberty from below. In this technical sense, if we understand a totalizing culture to be one with a singular, reductive, conformist, and system-serving conception of identity, infantilizing consumerism certainly enjoys many of totalism's attributes. And if market totalism, unlike its historical twin, totalitarian state tyranny, suggests a soft, mind-controlling form of indirect coercion, then there's something at least a little totalizing, if not fully totalitarian, about the sort of identity that grows out of brands and is dependent on forms of behavior in which we welcome our voluntary servitude to markets. We might ask Rushdie and those like him how it is that when politics dominates every other sector of life, we call the result totalitarianism. And when religion dominates every life world, we call the result theocracy. But when the market dominates every sector of our lives and becomes the key to identity itself, we call the result liberty. To be sure, the market issues no fatwas, and that's no small matter. Yet to be a freeman or a free woman is to be a citizen, and this is not simply a matter of being unthreatened by mobs and uncoerced by the tyrannies that lurk from above. To be free in the public and positive sense entails more than not being unfree in the negative sense. There is a status between the subject and the citizen, the status of the private person, the individual, the consumer. This is the status too many moderns have misconstrued as identical with citizenship. Infantilized, mass-produced consumers are simply not citizens, however, and hence are free in no significant public sense. It is this middling status that Rushdie appears to equate with freedom, but surely it is something less than that. The issue is not consumerism, but consumerism is a form of identity. The problem is not capitalism, but capitalism is the sole determinant of what should be multiple life worlds. The problem is not the celebration of the private, but the tyranny of the private over everything public. The challenge is how to respond to a world in which the pluralism of many identities and the democracy of a multiplicity of sectors are supplanted by a world of one singular identity, one set of commercialized, infantilized tastes and desires, and one single market sector to which every other private and public good is subordinated. This is a formidable challenge, in part precisely because the new varieties of identity and totalism that we face in a world of ubiquitous markets are subtle and jeopardize our private freedom in no obvious way. Indeed, they may enhance private liberty. And though being a full-time consumer with a great many choices has nothing to do with citizenship, it can feel a lot like freedom, which is why so many happily branded consumers seem to feel, to paraphrase the pop song, freedom's just another word for lots of stuff to buy. We give you liberty, reads the ad for a Midwestern American baked potato chain a few years ago. And it goes on, because we give you the choice of toppings. The choice of toppings does not liberty make, however. At times, modern aficionados of consumer society resemble those self-deluded monkeys caught in a novel African monkey trap designed to exploit the weakness of will when egged on by their simian desires. The trap consists of a sturdy board, well anchored in the ground, that is drilled with a single hole just large enough to allow a relaxed paw to reach through it on the way into a little box on the other side where a nut rests. Once the nut is grasped, a stuffed fist is formed that cannot be withdrawn unless the monkey surrenders its booty. But of course it doesn't let go. It can't, it won't. Paralyzed by its desire, its paw already on the prize, Rushdie's prize, it struggles to withdraw its fist, nut in place, inside its hand. It is trapped by its own powerful and free will. Hours or days later, it's captured, its liberty a victim of its grasping unwillingness to let go. So too, we modern consumers, acting more and more like the adults the market hopes we will become, celebrate our liberty. No gun is at our heads to draw us to the malls and infomercials and e-com sites that eat up our time and erode our freedom. But we can't seem to let go. Are we free? Yes. Are we unfree? Yes. That is the dilemma. Thank you. I think it's the practice to have some questions now.
Yeah, I mean, plenty to chew on there, obviously. Unfortunately, we don't have too long because the reception is supposed to follow, so we've only really got about a quarter of an hour, I'm afraid. But
I'm sorry, that's
my
fault.
I'll leave you to share your own.
Thank you.
Choose your own questioners.
Please.
But I think he went a bit further, though, than just saying it's to do with commercialism. Isn't it about commodity fetishism, about production for production's sake? Isn't that the real challenge? To democratize capitalism.
Two points. Marx's primary focus was on the productivist phase of capitalism and on the mode of production and the way in which the control over the mode of production and the character of the mode of production was responsible for the twin virtues and vices of the capitalist world, its efficiency and productivity and wealth and its injustices and class war. I would argue that that form of analysis does not appropriately capture the essence of the consumerist end of the economy, and what I'm talking about is the consumerist end. The second and crucial difference, though, is that I am not a critic of capitalism per se. I am a critic of capitalism when it dominates the pluralism of our life worlds. My defense here is a defense of multiplicity and pluralism. I think recent history has shown that when social democracy, when Marxism attempts to create a command economy alternative to free markets in the economic sector, there are disastrous results both for the economy and for politics. What bothers me is the fact that having accepted that in the realm of command economy, we are now permitting the consumers marketplace to dominate every other life world, so that what I'm concerned about is the balance, the multiplicity, just as much as somebody who's a critic of theocracy is not a critic of religion, but a critic of religion as a triumphant order over every other phase of life. My quarrel is not with capitalism, but with markets as the sole strategy for life in what ought to be a far more diverse world. So there are obviously similarities here, but I think in a way this is a rather different form of analysis. Maybe worse, you would say, for being that, but nonetheless a different form. Yes, sir.
There is a roving mic, actually.
There's
so
a mic coming, which will help.
Might as well try and use it, if you wouldn't mind, so everyone in the room can hear the question.
What lines of continuity, if any, exist between Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and globalization today?
Well, from the beginning, it has been clear, I think, to every analyst of the capitalist system that the capitalist system is aggressive in both virtuous and hurtful ways. It doesn't stay in place. It's a dynamic system, and its dynamics make it uncomfortable within the bounds of nation states. That was clear to Smith, it was clear to Ricardo, it was clear to Marx, it was clear to Lenin, and it's certainly clear today. Markets globalize, and they always have. They want to maximize their customer base, they want to maximize their capacity both to produce and sell. So there are globalizing tendencies. For that reason, I don't think the strategy of somehow pulling back economic globalization will work. The only strategy I think available is one that globalizes democracy in the same fashion that the tendencies of capitalism itself from Smith onwards has tended towards globalization. I mean, the problem really is the nation state proved to be an unreliable box. It was a box opaque to the spread of democracy. It held democracy in but was porous to markets and let the economy out. So it holds in the very thing that we need to be globalized. And I think that's, but so there's certainly a continuity of thought that one could trace in some detail, I think, back to Smith's analysis. The interesting thing about Smith and the Scottish economists generally was that they understood the need for a box. They understood the need for a moral container for capitalism and talked about it at length. And modern market economists, perhaps under the sway of people like Milton Friedman, are of the view that the market provides its own ethos, its own ethics, and indeed it does, but not the ones that it thinks they think it does. Ken, yeah.
Thanks. There's a lot to think about there, but you left me wondering what you meant by globalization. That is to say, I'd have liked more on definition. At one stage, it's homogenization of the world, as when you would like to see globalization of democracy. Sometimes it's interdependence or complementarity, which is what international trade is about, I take it. Orange growers sell to car makers and so on. And thirdly, and I don't think I've exhausted it, globalization seemed to mean servility to a commercial tendency that's spreading throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So definitions, I think.
My intention was to start with a narrow and technical definition, namely the spread beyond national boundaries of markets in goods, in currency, in labor, and in resources, and suggest that that technical economic spread beyond the borders of these economic variables was accompanied by a logic, and I was trying to do today, explore that logic, a logic that then had tendencies of the kind that I've associated with totalization, with commercialization, with infantilization. I would never argue that the term itself, globalization, is anything more than a technical term for the spread beyond boundaries of whatever spreads, and technically it starts by being primarily economic factors. But what I really wanted to look at was the logic of that globalization and to suggest that the logic of those who want to sell goods moves in a different direction. That's why that quote to me of McNeil, the child merchandiser guy, was so telling, because he has no interest in children in particular, and he has no interest in infantilization. He just says, how are we going to sell across the divisions of taste that distinguish markets? And his answer was a technical one. Well, how can we sell to those who share the same taste? That's children. So infantilization becomes not an object or an intention in its own right, and certainly not part of the definition of globalization, but rather an ancillary logic of those who wish to globalize markets successfully and need to sell to consumers across the world and find that cultural diversity, which they might enjoy personally, obstructs their ability to sell goods across the world, and they look for ways to sell common goods to common tastes, and children then become part of that logic. So, I mean, you're quite right. If I in any way suggested that globalization itself as a term entails all those things, that's quite wrong, and that's not what I intend. I intend only to say the logic of those who then wish to pursue the economic globalization strategy leads in these directions. Yes, ma'am. I'll
come to you. Going round.
What's the answer to the million-dollar question? What's the changes in political institutions we need in order to counter the economics of globalization?
I'd obviously have to, we'd have to stay here for quite a while to deal with that, but I'll say one thing that I think it's not and the other thing that I think it is. And it's not as hard as people think it is, and I don't think it's exclusively a global civil society strategy, although that's a strategy which I myself am actually involved with members of the European Parliament and some Americans and with George Soros, who are looking to try to develop a more vibrant and robust international civic infrastructure. But as you know, in the third world, and there's a very good article in Government and Opposition, in fact, this month, which suggests that the NGO strategy is one that the third world doesn't like because NGOs are mostly first world institutions, and it looks to them like a stealth protectionism, another form of domination, of Western dominations. First we try to do it with the economy, and then that doesn't work, so we try to do it with civic institutions. So there are problems with civic institutions. In fact, there is already in place in the Concert of Nations approach and the existence of organizations like WTO and the IMF and the World Bank, institutions that could become the skeleton of an international regulatory financial enterprise were they to be used that way. And that's why, for me, the struggle comes back to a local political struggle, because as long as privatization ideology is so dominant, the nations in those organizations are simply going to acquiesce to the force of the interests they're supposed to be regulating. And so, in part, I would argue that the strategy we require is a strategy that begins to take on privatization and commercialization as an acceptable ideology inside of the Western nations, to reclaim control of our governments in the name of res publica, and then to have them do what they probably can do. The third world is right. The WTO is in the hands of the G8, and that's a bad thing from the point of view of global democracy, but it's a good thing from the point of view of exerting control over those institutions and using them for purposes of regulating the international economy, because it means 8 or 9 nations, if they want to pursue that strategy, could actually pursue it effectively. So I would argue that the struggle for global democracy in fact becomes a struggle for national or local democracy, first of all, and the kinds of ideologies that we support. Yes, sir. And I'll try to be briefer so you'll have a few more minutes. But why don't we take a series of questions quickly?
Well, I think if you're willing, we ought to go on a bit longer because there are obviously a lot of
good. That's
people who
ask
questions.
Pleased to. Yes, go ahead, sir.
When you talk about brands as brands which confer identity and our dependence upon them, I think the corollary of that may be our dependence on employment to give us the earning power to afford the brands. And therefore, in some respects, I wonder if people can be motivated to look to the state as a guarantor of some sort of acceptable conditions of employment. At the moment, it seems that people will be willing to work all the hours that their employer demands in order to afford the lifestyle that they feel they need. And your lecture reminded me of the work of Eric Erickson and his stages of human development. And, of course, he says that before one can reach a secure sense of identity, the first stage of human development that he refers to is a sense of basic trust. And it seems to me that the sort of more rounded, secure identity that we would want to foster derives primarily from relationships within the family. And it's those relationships within the family and the community which may be the underpinning of the sort of civil society and the sort of active, protective state which we would want to see go from strength to strength rather than wither away. And therefore, I wonder if people can be encouraged to see that the need for family-friendly employment policies and the need for the state to guarantee them some sort of security within their employment could be something that should be supported rather than putting all their eggs in the basket of their dependence upon the employer who at the present time guarantees their income.
Well, I think the logic you just described suggests why local political effort is the condition for global democracy, because again, I think that's what you've said is exactly right. In the long term, there's some interesting issues though, because capitalism itself is having problems. It's working the people to death whom it wants to have leisure time to buy all the goods they produce. And that really creates a kind of new contradiction, because in a way, the producers actually want consumers to have more time. Now, in the long term, it may be that automation will create a system in which there will be less work and more time for people to
shop, except they won't have the wherewithal to shop if they're depending on wages to do it. That's an old contradiction. Henry Ford said that he's got to pay his workers enough to buy the cars that he's producing. He understood that his workers were also the constituency to buy his goods. That set of issues is a more complex one, which suggests we have long-term issues around reward for work that I think no current ideology adequately addresses. And Rifkin's mistimed book called The End of Work, at a point when we were to have the lowest unemployment rates in the history of the United States, nonetheless, I think raises the right questions. And my colleague Richard Sennett here at the LSE has also written about these work issues, I think, in a very provocative way, as have, of course, Professor Giddens. So this area of work, compensation, leisure time, consumption, production, and the role of regulation in it is an absolutely crucial set of issues, and I think you've identified it as one of the key places where democracy needs to rethink its what it's doing.
Can I ask the questions, keep their questions fairly short so that we can give several people a chance?
Yes.
I just wondered if you'd like to comment on the experience of the earlier occasion when capitalism allowed itself to get trapped into a regulatory box, namely the national regulatory box. And obviously the idea is that from this you may wish to make some conclusions about how it might get itself constrained, trapped, whatever, in some future regulatory box on a global scale.
Well, to answer you very simply and a little too facilely, I would welcome the presence of that conundrum in the international zone. We should only be so lucky to be in the conundrum where we're trying to figure out how to deregulate the international market. At this stage, there is no danger of that whatsoever. And being an old-fashioned Montesquieuian social scientist, I look for what's missing before I, you know, speculate about what would happen. You're certainly right to say, were Democrats to succeed, there's no doubt that eventually they would create the kind of roadblock in the international economy that they created perhaps in the national economies a while ago. But to worry very much about that at a time when there are no meaningful regulatory institutions seems to be. Am I missing your question? Is that?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, tell me what your question is a little more pointedly. I thought that was just. Go ahead.
The question is, how did capitalism get constrained in the first structure, which has now been superseded by globalization? Does that give any lessons for how it might allow itself to be constrained, how Democrats might constrain it in some future structure?
Well, yes. I mean, that, of course, it does, and we already have that. In its own terms, it fails. Marx was certainly right about that. The contradictions of capitalism are annihilatory to capitalism. And there's no question the Asian crisis proved to a lot of people in the World Bank and the IMF that they were doing something wrong. They didn't quite figure out what it was they were doing wrong, but it's very clear that they were doing something wrong. And in fact, they are now open. I quoted a number, and I can get a lot more of them. The people inside the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO are worried. And they're not worried because there are a few people in Trafalgar Square or in Washington, D.C. or Seattle. They're worried because the economies of which they've taken charge seem to be threatening to go down the drain under their policies. So they, I think, are already welcoming the intervention, would welcome the intervention of states were they there. So in that sense, I mean, I think the history will repeat itself, and the wild capitalism of the United States after the Civil War eventually gave way to Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson's interventionism, not as a consequence of an appetite for intervention, but as a consequence of the surrender to some extent of the capitalists themselves. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt was correct when he said he saved capitalism, he didn't destroy it, and he's given that credit. So I think in that sense, yes, that's your question. Okay, thanks. Yes, sir, the back.
There's a professor here at LSE named Ian Angel who's written a book called The New Barbarian Manifesto, in which he's a free market advocate and says that the nation state is in its dying days. Central to his argument is this whole idea of rituals and ritualization. He says that we're so ritualized in our belief, in our trust of the nation state, that we fail to see outside of that box. My question for you then is, as far as infantilization or globalization, how do you see rituals evolving in those mm-hmm. spheres?
Well, that's a rich and big question. By the way, how does he spell barbarian? I sometimes worry about that. The centrality of the organization of ritual and the socialization of ritual is absolutely crucial to a consumer society, because if consumption is about nothing more than shopping, people actually don't make very good shoppers. Shopping time in American malls is down. People are shopping less and less because they don't enjoy being there very much. So the ritualization of it is extraordinarily important. So it raises a series of very interesting anthropological questions. I don't know his work, but I would argue that the relationship between democracy and the nation state, though fraught, has been very productive. And one of the problems democracy has is to figure out how to operate outside of the box of the nation state, because despite its dualistic and ambiguous relationship with the nation state, in the long term, as I think John Pocock correctly observes, there has been a strong connection. The two have grown up together, learned to live together, and even learned to serve one another. And I think stripped of the nation state box and of the ritual of nationalism, if you like, and of the patriotism that goes with nationalism, which has been part of the support for democracy, democracy has a very hard time. And I think, so I, without being able to begin to answer your question, I think it's a very good and significant question that has to be addressed. Yes?
You've stressed, of course, how crucial democracy is. You've also said that government is necessary, and given the example of, you know, individuals might go and buy the biggest cars and drive them how they like, but obviously, en masse, people would find that should be curtailed. You've also said a lot about the nation state and democracy yet again, and in several answers. You've never mentioned a further point, though, which would seem to be perhaps a logical conclusion to some of what you said, but I get the feeling you wouldn't actually go for it too much. Global government, at that a democratic global government, would seem to be something like a logical conclusion to what you are arguing for. But am I right in thinking you actually are not thinking of that and don't much like the idea? Well, I've been NGOs and so on, okay, civic yeah. institutions, but one of the big things perhaps against them, I mean, I'm all for them in many ways, and I am one, so to speak, they are not democratic at all. Civic, yes, maybe.
My problem with global government isn't theoretical, it's practical. I think there's almost no chance in a world of nation states, contentious nation states, of that being in the near future a effective response to what are already powerful transnational economic forces. So, you know, we can argue about how desirable it is, but if we wait around for it to happen in any sense, or even work for it to happen, I think the chance of doing something is going to be long gone. I think, moreover, the concert of nations approach, which is actually a 19th century approach, which worked for peace very well in the 19th century, has some possibilities for the 21st century global economy, and forms of confederal cooperation, Europe as a, I hate to say that in England, but Europe as a model for forms of transnational cooperation around the control of the economy, although some people think it's the other way around, the economy is in control of the idea of Europe right now. But still, you know, there are models there that fall well short of a global or world government that leave a lot of hope for. So I would argue that, you know, whatever utility it has as an ideal model down the road, there are a lot of things we can do short of that that are far more realistic and likely to have a short-term impact of much greater effect. David, yeah?
I find myself in agreement with a lot of what you've said, but I worry about the relentlessly negative characterization you've offered of globalization and the global order, I suppose, more generally. And that seems to me to have three ingredients: children, states, and the story of globalization itself. I mean, the level of children, it seems to me, you portray them, and it seems to consumers, essentially as cultural dupes. That is to say, you know, creatures and beings who can essentially are in the sway and awe of this great mass consumer industry. And yet, what we know about children and consumers also is, in some sense, they become more cynical. And cynical doesn't necessarily mean uncritical. It can often mean skeptical of claims before them. And certainly, most of the kids I know don't grow up simply wanting brand names, but actually with quite an empowered sense of what information and education and media opportunities provide. That's the first thing. Secondly, your account of states also seems to me wholly negative. Yet states still matter, and national democratic politics still matters. I mean, one of the things we know is that tax welfare trade-offs are very different around Europe, and yet one could be forgiven for thinking that the nation state was really wholly eclipsed by this sort of relentless account of globalization you've offered. And finally, thirdly, it seems to me the story of globalization itself, if told purely through the lens of economic globalization, that is the last 25 years or so, misses also other stories of globalization, which are important to tell if we're to have anchors, as you put it, or hand grips, you know, on an alternative institutional building. Those are the stories of multilateralism, the growth of international law, human rights law, the International Criminal Court, and so on. I must keep the question straight. But it seems that's a different form of globalization that is in some tension with economic globalization. And so finally, I would just simply say that there are, it seems to me, both at the level of the individual, as it were, and at the level of states, and within the framework of global governance itself, important anchors around which a global project of democracy can be built. But your account risks, let me just put it that way, risks eclipsing those holding points, and thus, in essence, becomes quite disempowering with respect to political agency.
Very quickly, I'll go three. You did one, two, three. Let me go three, two, one. And first of all, obviously, in the rhetoric of an hour, I can't possibly address all the stories that need to be addressed to give a fair account. I did refer to Bretton Woods and the post-war reconstruction to suggest there are other models, even within the institutions being vilified today. But I think I would say that story, unfortunately, is being told all too well by champions from Fukuyama to Tom Friedman and doesn't need the addition of my voice. I mean, if one wants to hear that story, that's a story that is told in every editorial page around the world that supports the story. So I'm not sure I need to tell a lot of it. It is an important story, and it's certainly part of the picture. With respect to states, I'm sorry I didn't make myself more clearly understood, because on the contrary, I thought what I was saying is that it is precisely in states and their politics that the rescue of the international economy was likely to be found, and that while in many ways the economy had bled through and was beyond the direct surveillance of national economies, national states still had the potential power. So I agree with you completely on that states remain not only major players, but the only player, and that was partly my answer to your question. On children, my point is not that children are enthralled to the global market. It's the other way around. The global market is enthralled to children. You know, the children haven't been seduced by the markets. The markets have been seduced by children. They are playing to the children. And the childish interest, the child is the sovereign of the new market. The children haven't been manipulated into buying things they don't really want. The market has precisely served exactly what children do want. And for children, it's a wonderful world, as long as they don't want to grow up. You know, and of course they don't in a way, which is part of why it's such a wonderful world for them to be in. So I mean that this wasn't the false consciousness. I'm not saying kids have false consciousness. Kids have true consciousness, and merchandisers have tapped their consciousness accurately to create global markets for global goods, which also get sold to adults as well. I agree with you completely about resistance. I think, children themselves change despite the attempt to keep them children. Children themselves are more wary and in the end smart about the efforts to sell to them than perhaps adults are. And there's a lot of hope in fact, the eventual resistance and resilience of children as they grow despite this. But it is a new form of repression, because in the old forms of repression, people tried to lock up the adult. You take the artist, you take the philosopher, and you put them in prison. That's how traditional totalitarian societies worked. What we try to do is free the child and keep the child working. It's not a matter of repressing the child. It's a matter of exploiting the child and letting children be children. And that's a much more seductive kind of and seemingly free approach. And that suggests a kind of insidious and difficult to combat strategy that for me is particularly dangerous. But I agree with you, a lot of the hope probably comes from the children themselves, who are going to, despite our best efforts, are going to grow up.
I'm really sorry, but I'm afraid we do have to stop there. Yes. There is a reception on the fifth floor in the senior dining room, I think, to which anyone is welcome and could pursue Professor Barber there, since he'll be the star of the show there. I think, Ben, you can judge from the liveliness of the response the success of your lecture. So thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.